welcome to the 297th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have a pretty cool show for you today. Lots of news from Amazon because their reInvent event is happening. It's reInvent event is happening right now. We also have a brand new device from Wyze because, I don't know, it's a day that ends in Y. We're going to be talking about Wi-Fi Halo just because the company got a lot of money. 5G in factories. We've got a Wi-Fi acquisition because Wi-Fi is so hot right now. And we just want to do a little update on Amazon Sidewalk for people who may have gotten some of the messaging lost in our last conversation from last week. Plus, our guest this week is Scott Turnbull, who is the Director of Technologies for US Ignite. We're going to be talking about smart cities and what it's going to take to actually make them happen here in the US. We also are going to have a message from our sponsor, Calix, and another message from one of our sponsors who is also a huge friend of the show, Lee Odess, CEO of Group 337 and the man behind Inside Access Control, which is an awesome newsletter for people in the access control business. He's written a book called Six Phase Changes Shaping Access Control. In the book, he takes a deep dive into the transformation affecting the physical access control and smart lock industry. So everything from multifamily to business, anything dealing with locks and getting in and out of buildings. So in this book, he talks about the six phases. They are market reach, technology, innovation engines, marketing, talent, and the it factor. So why should you buy it? If you are in the access control or smart lock industry, this is going to help you prepare for everything coming ahead. Lee feels like the industry has been constantly looking through the rearview mirror when it comes to product development and business practices, so he wants to help it look forward. So if you are a fan of business transformation stories or you are in the access control business, you should really check out this book. Where can you find it? You can go to www.accesscontrolbook.com and pick up your digital copy. Thanks, Lee. Okay, Kevin, let's just start with AWS because reInvent is happening. And thanks to the pandemic, I guess, this is a 3-week long event that started this week.
I don't think it's because of the pandemic. I think it's because they just do more each year than the year before.
Good Lord, this thing is huge. There's lots of rebroadcasts of everything, which is nice because sometimes, you know, for different time zones, for whatever it's worth, probably get 3 to 5 chances to see most of the sessions over this time period. But Andy Jassy did his big keynote. It was almost 3 hours yesterday. It was a lot of information, and we're going to cover some of it now. So buckle up, Buttercup, because here we go. Starting off, there was a lot of chip news. Most of it does not relate to the Internet of Things, but they did talk about their new chips for machine learning that they've built. There was a lovely story about the overall computing side. But on the IoT side, a couple things to know. IoT, one of the big challenges is we work a lot with containers. Basically, you try to use containers because it's a small amount of compute, and you can actually deploy a container in the cloud or somewhere closer to the edge, and it's the same effort, right?
You could do it on a Pi.
You can even do it on a Pi, yes. And there are services out there that let you run it on embedded devices running RTOSes, but we won't go there. I don't think Amazon is doing that. So in that vein, in the container vein, they announced a program called AWS Proton, which is a managed service for managing your containers. So AWS has 3 container offerings. There's Amazon Elastic Kubernetes Service, Amazon Elastic Container Service, and AWS Fargate. Fargate is what they do with the edge. That's probably the one most of our audience is familiar with. So Proton pulls all of that together and lets your developers create this stack and lets you toss applications on those services, and they're going to provision and manage that so you don't have to make sure that you've got the compute power available for it.
And if I'm understanding correctly, I did not sit through the keynote and such that you did. But as I read this, two of these services have the word anywhere after them. And as I read the descriptions, it seems to me these are what I would call on-prem available, meaning you could run these on your own data, in your own data center.
You're right. So Amazon did do a service called ECS Anywhere and EKS. So that's Container Service Anywhere and Kubernetes Service Anywhere. And what that's doing is that actually lets you run your containers on your premises and on your own servers, and they will look and behave exactly like your containers running in Amazon's cloud. And that's really important for linking those two things. Proton is a service that's going to manage all of those containers that you're deploying and help you provision and send things up to it without worrying too much. But those are the underlying services. So that's a lot about containers. And many of you are probably like, I'm here for the light bulbs. Bear with us because the future is here.
And it's looking scary, if I'm reading all this correctly.
It is looking, I was going to say smart, but you're
creepy.
Not wrong.
Creepy.
Okay, well, this is for industrial. Let's talk about it for industrial.
True.
Mm-hmm. So Amazon announced 5 services using machine learning that are worth noting. And these are probably cool for industrial settings. So here we go. Amazon Monitron. That is going to let you monitor your machines. So it's got sensors, gateway, machine learning, all of that. You deploy this service. Amazon Monitron will be like, oh, your centrifuge, the motor running it is behaving weirdly. So that's what that is. That is in preview right now. Amazon Lookout for Equipment. That is going to let your existing equipment and sensors in the field, you can send their data to Amazon, and Amazon's going to use their machine learning to do predictive maintenance and detect failure. So this is going to, like, I won't say it will crush lots of startups out there, but there are plenty of startups doing this in the industrial space.
This part of their news announcement on this kind of freaks me out. Using Amazon Lookout for Vision, they can determine minuscule, I'm quoting now, minuscule defects in silicon wafers, such as a missing capacitor on a printed circuit board.
That's what it's trained to do. So they'll have a model trained to do that. And chip makers have been using this sort of thing for years, actually. I've talked to Seagate and Intel both about using computer vision to monitor yields and defects in their chips coming off the factory line.
So the cameras, though, that to do this, have to be pretty darn close, I would think, to the actual product.
Yeah, they're part of the production line.
Okay, dokie, okay, okay.
Because it's really awesome for them.
Yeah, no, that
makes
sense.
It's really awesome for them.
That's better than having somebody with a little microscope saying, yep, this wafer's good. Yep, that's no good.
Exactly. Or worse, sending it out in the world and it failing in a device. Ah.
Oh, that never happens.
Never. They also have AWS Panorama Appliance and Panorama Software Development Kit. And Panorama is going to be computer vision algorithms. The one for appliances, that is going to work with existing cameras that somebody has in their manufacturing plant. And then the software development kit is going to let the camera manufacturers put Panorama algorithms on their cameras and just send that straight to the cloud. All of this basically is saying, hey, Amazon is deadly serious about getting into industrial IoT. All of these services are designed to, I mean, they're going to compete with services that already exist from several companies. I'm thinking like companies like Augury, companies like EverActive, just tons of businesses already out there doing this. And plenty of companies that have already built their own algorithms for these services. So I'm really interested to see the take up rate here and what the rest of the companies already in the space think about AWS's services. So
there's one more news bit in here that you don't have on the show notes, but I'm going to bring it up. So there is also for like customer service centers, call centers, 5 new Amazon Connect capabilities. And most of it is like customer management and so on. But there's one really not freaky, but interesting thing in here that they're announcing, and it is available in preview. It's called caller authentication. So when you call into a call center and you need to authenticate yourself by typically at, you know, answering 17 questions that you can't remember the answers to, this is actually going to scan your voice if you opt in using what they call voice ID. And it analyzes your rhythm, pitch, and tone to determine if it's really you. You actually have to train it one time, but the next time you call back, it will actually say, oh, yeah, this is Stacy. We don't need to ask her all those questions. What can I do for you, Stacy?
Yeah, and Amazon did a lot with recognition and biometrics. There's actually a session all about using various Amazon biometric services for identification, both by call center things, but even by AI and by things. And that's kind of part of this whole, like, how do we train devices to understand that you are who you say you are, which is a really big issue when we're putting more agency and intelligence into these devices. But it is kind of like a little unsettling.
I want to pay by voice.
Oh, really? I don't know if I'd feel comfortable with that yet, but okay.
Maybe with a scan of the face as well, you know?
Yeah, because I could just be like, Kevin, could you say I authorize this? Boom. I authorize this.
Yeah, where's that expense report?
Because like we have deep fake on voice already, so.
That's true.
I don't know, Kevin.
All right, never mind.
Okay, back to AWS reInvent. Well, we never really left. We just went on this deep, dark Black Mirror kind of segue. But back to that. Big news on the serverless front. We talk about serverless all the time. For those of you who are like, what? Serverless? Serverless, it actually does happen in a server. It just means that the job you're asking the computer to do, instead of paying to keep a server running all the time, ready to do that job, you actually only spin up the server. So you only call on the server when you need it, and it does the job, and then it spins back down so you don't have to pay for it. Many IoT services are serverless because it's cheaper. And Amazon's serverless platform is called Lambda. Andy Jassy, during his keynote, said that 50% of new workloads are on Lambda, which is huge. This is a big deal. And they changed the billing for the Lambda platform. So now it's going from 100 milliseconds, so like the billing increments every 100 milliseconds, to just 1 millisecond. And that is amazing. Well, he says it's saving some of their customers up to 70%. I feel like that's probably an exceptional customer, but it is nice. I mean, remember when you had to pay for long distance by the minute? You would be like, oh, I only talk for, you know, you'd be like, okay, we've only got 30 more seconds. Bye, 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 bye.
They're going to round up. Quick, goodbye.
So that's this kind of thing, only it's your devices that are calling in to like report state. So that is not all the Amazon news. There's one more piece of news. And that is not all the Amazon news at all. We're just trying to cherry pick things that relate to the IoT. So the other piece of news has to deal with actually a partnership with Research in Motion, the company we all may know about from BlackBerry. BlackBerry has now partnered with Amazon Web Services to build and market its vehicle data integration and monitoring platform that it calls Ivy. And BlackBerry used to be big in the smartphone space. Then it went with QNX and started doing all this like vehicle and embedded device security. And it's done really well in the automotive space. So what it's doing is it's creating a connected car service data service. And it's going to let car makers read their vehicle sensor data from all of their vendors. It's going to normalize that data, and it's going to let the car manufacturers see what's happening on the cars.
Yeah. And I was always wondering if Amazon would get more into cars, because I've talked about this before. Like, you always have to add something on or whatever, you know, because there's other platforms that are just generally used by the car manufacturers. And I know they're not doing that with this, but just to tap into QNX is huge, because I remember when Research in Motion was going down the tubes and QNX was actually just firing up, and they said, this can be big in cars. And it's now in 175 million cars.
Yeah, it's big in cars. Yep. Yay! From smartphones to car data. Sure. All right. Now, we're not quite done talking about Amazon for the show, but we're going to take a little break to talk about Wyze, because they have that new device out, Kevin.
They do. I believe we talked about a couple weeks ago that it was determined that they're coming out with a watch. They didn't announce it at the time, but I think there was an FCC filing or something. In any case, they did announce the watch. It is available for pre-order, and it's called the, get ready, Wyze Watch. Some people are going to hate on me for saying this, and that's fine. It has a square face like the Apple Watch, which I prefer over a lot of these circular smartwatch faces. That's just me. It does look like an Apple Watch, but it won't cost like an Apple Watch. It's $19.99 plus shipping. I did pre-order one. My shipping was like $4.50. So whatever, with tax, it was $26. What are you getting for 20 bucks on your wrist? Probably not much.
Yeah, because they just did the Wise Band.
That's one thing I don't get. You've used the Wise Band. I have not. So
I thought it was lame.
I don't
lame.
Know what's missing or added. What, say again?
I thought it was lame. But let's tell me what it has, and I'll tell you what the Wise Band has, and we can work on this.
Okay. So you get a blood oxygen sensor, 24/7.
No.
You get a touch screen.
Yes.
Okay. And on that touch screen, you can read previews of email, text, and notifications from your phone over Bluetooth, I presume.
Yes.
Okay. That's good.
I don't know if you can read email, but you can get calendars and calls and texts.
Okay. This is made of aluminum. I don't know what the Wise Band was made of.
Me either.
Okay. You have, and I'm sure the band has this, shortcuts to all your Wise ecosystems.
Yes.
Okay. I bet you the experience is a little bit better because I have a feeling the screen is a lot bigger here.
Yes.
Yes. Water resistant up to 2 meters.
I believe it was, yes. Well, I don't know how many meters, but yes.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. Heart rate every 5 seconds.
Sorry, I lied to you. It is water resistant up to 50 meters for 10 minutes.
Oh, well, there you go. All right, you go, Jacques Cousteau. Heart rate every 5 seconds all day, 7/24.
Yes.
Okay. Sleep monitoring?
Yes.
Steps?
Yes.
And health cycle, women's health cycle tracking?
No.
Okay.
Maybe. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't either. Also, which is interesting to me, and I don't know how this is going to work yet, so we'll wait till I get it. They say it's compatible with popular apps. I presume, because there's only Bluetooth in it, there's no Wi-Fi or anything else, you're not actually installing apps. I presume these are notifications. And what they show is Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram, Messenger, Gmail, Twitter, and Wise. So I'm guessing notifications.
Yeah. How long does the battery life last on this? Does it tell you?
So they say 9 days.
Oh, the band is 10 to 14 days. And by the way, the band, just for comparison, is $24.99 plus shipping. But yours is a pre-order, so that's a little fancy.
That's true. That's true. This comes with a silicone strap watch band. You can pre-order leather ones for $10 each, which is actually kind of inexpensive. This comes in two sizes, 47 millimeter, 44 millimeter, no difference on price. I believe, and I don't see it here now, but I believe that you can be notified that your phone is ringing and you can hang up on a phone call. There's no built-in mic or speaker or anything, so you can't use any voice, anything. It's just notifications, essentially.
Okay. I do recall the phone calls I would get from your Apple Watch, which was a little Dick Tracy of you, so I'm glad we won't have that again. All right. So you've ordered the Wise?
Yes, I did. I did order this just so we can give it a try.
We'll see what Kevin thinks of it. Maybe I'll ship you the band if I can find it. I can't remember what I did with it. That's the problem with Wise Gear. They're so cheap that you're kind of like...
Yeah, you toss it somewhere like, eh, whatever.
I mean, that's not really a problem. I shouldn't complain. It's so cheap, but it is kind of a problem. Okay.
So just so folks know, this ships in February.
Oh, okay.
And there are 20 days left to pre-order. And it shows me that there are 44,799 backers. So, because that's how they do this thing. So it looks like almost 50,000 people have ponied up the money.
Because it's not a lot of money.
No, exactly. Exactly.
And just for people keeping score, last week, Wise, I believe, launched the sprinkler. And then the week before that, there was a vacuum. And the week before that.
We could just do a Wise podcast each week. Product of the week is...
Amazon, Wise, good Lord.
I will say this. I'm intrigued that you can't control anything else but Wise. And it made me realize they really have very quickly built out a whole smart home ecosystem. Not maybe not complete, but if that's their goal, which we assume it is, that's pretty impressive. That's been a good year for them, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, they've done an amazing job building out an entire ecosystem. And it is a closed ecosystem with the exception of talking out to Madam A and G.
So, and it is cheap.
And it is cheap, cheap, cheap. All right. Wi-Fi. We put this in the newsletter, and I've had the COO of this company on the podcast last June, but Wi-Fi Halo company, Morse Micro, raised an additional $13 million last week. And just a reminder, because I don't think a lot of people know about Wi-Fi Halo, and I think it's because not a lot of people are actually using Wi-Fi Halo. Wi-Fi Halo was a Wi-Fi effort launched a couple years ago to build Wi-Fi that would extend deeper into the home, so like your basement. It was designed to be both low power and to travel further with less attenuation. And it's kind of like it wants to be Bluetooth, basically.
I remember hearing about it a few years back, and then I almost never heard of it again.
No one's building anything for it. So the question to ask this company, which is based in Australia, which is, they love to mention this, that's where Wi-Fi was invented. There is a company down there. It's a research organization that sued a lot of people for Wi-Fi. But these are the two inventors that helped invent Wi-Fi. They're behind this company, and they're really trying hard to make it work. What we're going to be looking for is when those chips that they're building get embedded in devices. Right. Because so far, not seeing it.
Real quick, is there some kind of protocol standard for this?
Oh, yes. Wi-Fi Halo is the standard.
Okay.
That is a IEEE standard, yes.
Yeah. I'm going to have to look up what the 802.whatever number is later then. Okay.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
That's okay. I want to read up on it a little bit, even though I really question, this is now $30 million in total they've raised. If nobody puts the chips in the products, it doesn't matter how much they raise.
You got to put the chips in the products. Okay.
Oh, boy.
I don't know where that came from. If you want to hear about it instead of read about it, you can go to episode 270 of our podcast, where we talked about Wink being a bad boyfriend, and we interviewed Vahid Manian, who is the COO of Morse Micro. And we talked about what it is, why no one's using it. He talked about why he thinks it's great and why we might be seeing it used for sending video over longer distances. So.
And now we know that Kevin got outed for not listening to the interview.
You know, it is okay, Kevin. We produce a lot of content.
We do.
All right. Speaking of wireless, let's talk about 5G in factories because I just love it. 5G, a lot of hype. Like right now with 5G iPhones out, everyone's like, do I need this? The answer is no, not if you're a consumer. But if you are an enterprise and you're doing factories, 5G is actually a really cool innovation because it has low latency. So, and that's important when you're trying not to chop someone's arm off if it gets in the way and a sensor detects that. It's also, you know, other things. But I'm like, think about how dangerous factories are and how fast of a response time you need. And if you can get rid of wires in factories, you can move the operations around and change up your operations a little bit more easily. It makes it a lot more flexible. It's very exciting. So last week in the newsletter, I wrote about John Deere, which had purchased 5 CBRS licenses from the FCC in the auction over the summer. They spent $545,000-something buying their own dedicated spectrum for 5G networks in their factories. And Bosch, German conglomerate, who's big into industrial automation and Industry 4.0, as they love to call it, they are gradually deploying 5G in all 250 of their factories around the world. And that's actually really cool. They acquired their own, it's not CBRS spectrum, they call it a vertical spectrum license, but it's their own dedicated spectrum, just like John Deere did. So they did that in Germany, and they're trying to do it in some other places. So I just wanted to be like, hey, while we're all skeptical about 5G for consumers and in our phones, it's actually happening in factories. So don't discount it over much. Okay. And now back to Wi-Fi.
I was wondering if you were going to notice that.
I'm like, oh, we should have stuck the Wi-Fi stories together, but we didn't. Nordic Semiconductor, which makes Bluetooth chips, has now purchased the Insignia Wi-Fi division of Imagination Technologies, and they are going to be making Wi-Fi chips, which puts them pretty much with everybody else, because even Silicon Labs, which was kind of late to the Wi-Fi game, they purchased a Wi-Fi company 2 years ago. Time doesn't fly when you're in a pandemic. Qualcomm, they have Wi-Fi. They purchased several Wi-Fi companies, Atheros being one of them, part of Broadcom. So now we have Nordic buying Wi-Fi. The reason is because you can't do the Internet of Things without Wi-Fi.
Well, I mean, you could, but...
Why would you?
Yeah, I'm telling you, I'm moving as much as possible in terms of devices to Wi-Fi in my house.
I think that's crazy.
He's cray-cray. Well, because I tell you what, when you take, like, just use a light bulb, for example, whether it's Bluetooth, Zigbee, or Wi-Fi, the latency on the Wi-Fi is almost always lower. It's just instant. It happens. And that's what I want in my smart home.
But those are powered. So any sensors you have, you're going to have some sort of hub. And Bluetooth is a terrible one because it needs...
Very true.
I get frustrated with that.
From a sensor standpoint, I agree with you. But the devices that I interact with, Wi-Fi.
And I think I'm actually very curious from the radio protocols that will matter in the smart home going forward. Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and I think Thread. So we're going to see more 802.15.4.
You're putting all your chips on Project Chips, huh?
I am. I have faith.
Okay.
My faith may be misplaced, but it's obviously late. My faith is, it's, you know, we were supposed to hear before the end of this year. It's been about a year, actually, since Chip was announced last December. So, you know, I don't think it's coming in time for Christmas.
The year is not up. And you've got, right after the new year, you've got the virtual Consumer Electronics Show, where I suspect we'll hear at least introduction of the first products.
I hope so. All right. Well, they're out there. I mean, that's what the HomePod Mini that has Thread, because it's going forward for Chip. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Eero routers do too. The new Eero routers.
Oh, yeah. That was a nice segue. Look at you. Speaking of Eero routers, which will one day get Amazon Sidewalk protocol. See what I did there? Let's just do a quick review of Amazon Sidewalk, because we're getting a lot of coverage out there about people saying, Sidewalk, they're forcing you to opt in, which is true. It's creepy. Here's how you opt out. So for those of you who want to opt out, we wanted to tell you how. And what will happen is all fourth generation Echo devices, the speaker and the, what are they called? The dots. I was like, the mini dots. Those are all Sidewalk devices. And the Eero devices also will have Sidewalk radios in them. By the way, the Sidewalk radio is made by Semtech, which is the LoRaWAN company. This is not actually LoRa radios. It's 900 megahertz. It will work with some LoRa sensors, but this is Amazon's proprietary network. So that's a little confusing. But if you want to opt out, you have to go to the Madame A app on your device, go to More, go to Settings, Account Settings, and Amazon Sidewalk. And then from there, you can opt out. I don't think you should. I know that Amazon has a rep for being creepy. And things like Ring and all of this, they made some mistakes. I think Sidewalk, the protocol as it's written, Amazon does not see the devices or the data passing over its own Sidewalk network. Amazon does. So there's two reasons why you would probably opt out. One, you think it's creepy that Amazon knows everything about you and the devices tracking over this network. It doesn't. Two is because it's going to use some of your bandwidth. And that bandwidth is 500 megabytes per month, up to. This network is running at 80 kilobits per second. So you're going to have to see a heck of a lot of traffic.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if the maximum throughput of Sidewalk devices that need to leverage somebody's private network are capped at 80 kilobits per second, I really don't think, especially early on, you're going to get even 100 meg of data used. I just don't think so.
And that's half a gig. To put that in perspective, Comcast is now bringing back their data caps post-pandemic. That is not actually over. point. And that data cap is going to be 1.2 terabytes of data. There are how many gigs in a terabyte, Kevin?
There'd be 1,024 technically, but 1,000.
Yes. So 1,024. So not a lot is the bottom line.
I would agree, but it's all relative because I look at my, you know, internet usage on a monthly basis and I go around a terabyte a month.
Okay.
From working from home, from watching all of our content online because we don't pay for cable. We have YouTube TV, you know, all the other services. So you have to keep it in perspective. Some people do or will hit that cap.
So if you're close to your cap, then yes, you should probably disable this. And by close to, I mean like 1.1, we'll give you, I mean, it's half a gig, so we'll give you that extra 100.
In the grand scheme, it is not a lot. That is correct. But you need to be careful.
Okay. Yes. And so that would be a reason to opt out, in my opinion. The idea of sharing your network, though, is not new. Phone actually was one of the first companies to do this way back in the early days of the internet.
FON phone.
FON phone. Mm-hmm. Yes. You got on there and you shared a portion of your Wi-Fi network securely to others who needed access to a Wi-Fi. Comcast, again, I am naming the Borg. It does that with their Wi-Fi service. It actually takes part of your Wi-Fi or any of their customers' Wi-Fi connection and uses that to create a public Wi-Fi network. So this is not unusual or new.
And in fairness, you're actually doing this today with your Helium router.
Yes, I am doing this today because there is an economic necessity for free to low or no cost, low power wide area networks, which is what Amazon is trying to create. And the only way to build out these networks is some sort of distributed model. And I think if you are a proponent of the Internet of Things, that you should be participating in something like this, because the advantages are going to be huge and the devices that we're going to be able to build and the services on this are going to be really cool.
I agree with you. But my thing is, you made a choice by purchasing a device and said, I'm going to give up my bandwidth to help the greater cause here.
Right.
This is, okay, we've got tens of millions of endpoints out there. Now let's flip a switch and we just create this ginormous Internet of Things network. That's...
I know.
I'm not saying it's bad. I get why you're doing that, but that's the difference to me.
Right. And I get it. So this is me trying to make the case for you to look at this, and I know why they made it opt out, because they need to create a big network. It's network effects for actual networks. But I'm making the case that you should think about why you're opting out if you opt out. Mm-hmm. So that is my case. Okay. That is all on Sidewalk for the second time. And now I think it is time for us to go to the listeners for a question from this week's IoT podcast. Oh, but first I'm going to tell you who brought you the IoT podcast hotline, and then we're going to tell you the November winner. So the Internet of Things podcast hotline is brought to you by Very. Very is a fully distributed IoT engineering firm helping you get your biggest projects fully operational on time and on budget. You can discover what Very's multidisciplinary teams can do at www.verypossible.com. Okay, this episode, it is time for us to tell you who the winner for November is, and they will win an August lock. And that winner is Tom. So Tom, congratulations. You are getting the August Wi-Fi lock shipped to you. We will contact you at the number that you called us from, or as is often the case, people will be like, I think I won. And you will email me. But, you know, I am going to try to find you, not in a scary way. All right. If you would like to be entered to win for the month of December, you can call us at 512-623-7424 and ask us a question, or you could just call and be entered to win. And December's winner will receive a smart speaker. So if you would like to win this smart speaker of your choice, please give us a call, 512-623-7424.
Are these the choices between the $99 options?
Oh, yes. These are the choices between the $99 Echo, the HomePod Mini, or the Google Nest Audio. So pick your poison. Okay, this week's question is from Dean, who Dean is one of our regular callers. And, you know, I like to think that we're helping him as he helps us, because he lets us know how things perform. Like, he's the guy who told us that the Hue lights outside will work through a Minnesota winter. So yay. Thanks, Dean. This week, he wants to know about his Nest thermostat settings. Let's hear it.
Hi, this is Dean from Minnesota. Thank you for the help in my IoT world inside and out. My current situation is that I used to use IFT for my Nest thermostat, and it would pick up on my location. So when I got so close to home from my commute, the furnace would kick in, which is kind of a big deal when you turn it down in Minnesota winters. It shows that it's working. It no longer works. I don't know. And I have a Samsung Note 9 phone. I cannot find a workaround, and it's very frustrating. And I'm curious if there is a solution or something, a workaround for my phone to use its location situation for my Nest thermostat. Thanks so much. Love your show.
All right, Dean. Actually, you can do this right in the Nest app. I'm looking at it right now on a different Android phone, and I'm tapping on my Nest Hello doorbell so I can see it. Oh, there's squirrels out there today. Up at the top right, you'll see the little settings wrench. You're going to want to tap that, And then in the next menu, you're going to choose Home/Away Assist. And this is where you actually set up your home and away settings. But what you'll see is in this next screen, it says, what decides if you're home? This is kind of, I don't want to say hidden, but I have a feeling a lot of people don't actually click this because it's almost like it's just a question, right? Like, I don't really need to know. You'll just figure it out, Ness. But you do need to tap it because when you do, there's an option to use the phone location, which is by default set to no. So by tapping that, changing it to yes, your phone location will be used. It's not a very big geofenced area, according to the Google Help documents that I looked at. However, it's going to accomplish what you want. I don't think it's going to work from a mile away from your house as you approach, but maybe as you pull up, the heater will kick on, for example, and start warming up the house before you even get into it. So you can do it. You don't need a hub, a smart home hub of any kind. You just need to have the Nest app and just set that setting in the settings.
Yay! All right. So remember, if you would like us to answer your question, give us a call at 512-623-7424, and you'll be entered to win a smart home speaker of your choice. Okay. That's about it for the news portion of this show, but please stay tuned for a message from our sponsor and our guest, Scott Turnbull, who is the Director of Technology for US Ignite. He is going to be talking to us about how we actually make our city smart and how we should think about building out this smart city infrastructure. Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Calix, and I have Pam Ferguson here from the company. Pam, let's just get started with you telling me a little bit about Calix.
Absolutely, Stacy. Calix is 100% focused on enabling service providers of all sizes to deliver amazing experiences in the home. We provide cloud software, systems, and services to communication service providers. In turn, those customers, the service providers, deliver future-proofed and autonomous fiber networks. It's so great to be chatting with you again today about the Revenue Edge. Your listeners can find out more about it at calix.com/revenue-edge.
So Calix is helping service providers go beyond managed Wi-Fi with their Revenue Edge solution. How do apps fit in?
Well, many large service providers have apps focused on billing and other account information. We see that mobile app as an even more critical part of the home network experience than just account info. Consumers are inundated with a wide range of connected home devices and their corresponding apps. It causes confusion for many, and sadly, that confusion drives frustrated calls back to the service provider. When service providers weren't involved in solutions purchased by those subscribers for their connected homes in the first place, it can be super challenging for them to really help. We're working with the service providers looking to change up this unfortunate, I'll call it a cycle, delivering the in-home experience, starting with a subscriber app for seamless turn-up, and then ongoing tools like parental controls, network security, and prioritization. It all changes the focus. Service providers can then curate amazing experiences for their subscribers and actually help their subscribers if there are issues down the road. A personalized version of our app we call Command IQ puts the service provider brand into the palms of the subscriber's hands and gives them a direct communication channel to suggest new ways to enhance their home network depending on their own needs.
What does Calix have in store for the Command IQ app that you use to enable service providers?
Command IQ is already widely adopted by many of our customers. It's seen as a best practice to interact with subscribers. Adoption rates by their subscribers are upwards of 80% right now. It's fantastic. We recently announced a new look and feel for Command IQ. It's launching in early 2020. We're pretty excited about how this clean, intuitive design will continue to evolve the relationship between the service provider and their subscriber. That's really what the Blast Ultimate Wi-Fi experience is all about from Calix, bringing exceptional home network experiences to every corner of the subscriber's home.
Thanks, Pam. Can you remind people where to go to find out more information about Calix?
If you're with a service provider, you can go to calix.com/revenue-edge. If you're an end consumer and want to learn more about our awesome Blast Wi-Fi 6 systems or Command IQ, you can check out blastwifi.com.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Scott Turnbull, who is Director of Technology at US Ignite. Hi, Scott, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much for having me.
Excellent. We are glad you're here because we are talking about smart cities, which frankly, we haven't talked about in a while because they felt pretty stagnant. And so I'm excited to have you talk about how we can actually jumpstart this and what we need to do, I guess, as a society to make smart cities both real and way more useful for both citizens and the cities themselves. So it's a tall order. We're going to do a lot. But first, you should probably tell us about US Ignite. Quickly, what is it?
Thank you. Well, US Ignite is a nonprofit. We're based out of Washington, D.C., but we're a national nonprofit that works with communities across the country to help accelerate the smart city movement. And for us, that means the adoption of technologies to help advance and improve the quality of life for people living in the in these communities, and also to help promote the development of networks that support these advanced applications and services for an integrated, holistic growth of that quality of life for people living in these communities across the country.
Okay. So working together to get smart cities. So let's start off with, I'm a little disappointed because I feel like we should be further on the smart cities path. And what I feel like we have are smart lighting. There's a lot happening around the transition from other lights to LEDs and intelligence around those that kind of happened 5 to 10 years ago in most places. Mm-hmm. And then we've got a bunch of pilots and innovation zones. So can you help me understand why have we stagnated? Or have we stagnated? Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think you're both right and wrong, only because the first issue is that smart city is a blanket term for a whole spectrum of advances happening within communities. So we always want flying cars and jetpacks and ignore the progress that we've made in society in the meantime. So on a base level, there is an advancement in many cases in local communities that people maybe don't think about as part of the smart city movement. Those might be auto renewal, online services for driver's licenses or public benefits and things like that. It might be advanced 311 information services. It might be advanced routing of 911 services. If you think about something as simple as a location service for your phone, typically when you pick up a phone, when they were wired landline things, the emergency services will be able to locate you in real world to send somebody directly to your house. But the moment we all went to cell phones, that became a much more difficult prospect for emergency dispatchers. So we had to put advanced technologies in place to locate people's phone in real time, even if they had the location services turned off. And while that might be opaque and something that's difficult to appreciate, it is something that we've made great advances on. Next Generation 911 is a great, outstanding smart city services we've made a lot of advancements on in the last 10 years. But you're right in that other services are lagging around video surveillance or intelligently reconfiguring a city to respond to the people living in it. That's how personally I define smart cities. So I would agree that we're not there yet. A smart city to me is a city that reconfigures itself based on the day-to-day needs of the people living in it, whether that be rerouted public transit systems, whether that be customized routes for waste management or waste delivery or utility delivery. Those are all, to me, what I think of that event horizon of the smart city. And I would agree we're not there yet, but we have made a little bit more progress than I think people appreciate.
Okay, so we are further along. That's good. And what are the barriers to progress in getting us to this reconfigurable city?
I think really the challenge that we're facing is the nature of the integrated management of these systems and maybe some of these city services and the implications for the citizens living in them. We need better policies and we need better agreements to make them happen. So let me start with the people side, the citizens, the people living in the community, and how a city can responsibly deliver some of these services to the people living in them. So let's just take the idea of monitoring or video surveillance that might be when people talk about LED lighting, for instance, often there's a camera mounted on these street LED lights, or there might be other cameras for traffic systems within the community. And the immediate problem that cities have are data management. Privacy is about transparency to the citizens, how their data is being used and collected, transferred to third parties, how often is it retained. Those are policy problems that cities have, that they have difficulty forming something that is easily transparent to the people living in it, to getting buy-off from the voters within that region to make sure they're willing to fund it or bond these systems. That's a different working relationship that city IT shops have with their citizens than they've typically had. In the past, city IT shops have mostly been around IT support for community systems, desktop systems for their city officials or database systems that collect and aggregate data. But the new paradigm of data collection platforms within a city require a forward-facing, external-facing element to these IT shops that no one is quite sure where it lives. Does it live in the public utility sector? Does it live in the IT department? Does it live in some other department that has yet to be created or yet to be identified? A lot of cities have approached this with sort of a patched approach. There's a new position called the Chief Innovation Officer that is really just the city's way of saying, we have a whole bunch of new technology we don't know how to deal with yet, so we're going to bring this position in to think about these forward-facing elements and their implications. But it's far from a city service that has been refined and operationalized to provide efficient services to the local citizenry. So just that aspect of how you deploy it and how do you manage it and how do you communicate to your citizens both the value and what the impact is to their daily lives, that's not settled. So no one knows how to bring that forward-facing management piece into it.
Okay, and that's what we're going to talk about today. We're talking about building out an entirely new layer of infrastructure for cities in a lot of ways, and maybe there are several layers, but let's just say I think of IoT very broadly as sensors that are sending information either to the cloud or to a data center somewhere that is able to analyze that information and take action in real time. So usually it's not to the cloud because it needs to happen faster than that. That's hugely broad. And figuring that out is really hard because cities have all these different vendors approaching them. They have different departments trying to buy this stuff. So let's start with just an organizing principle around who in the city should be in charge of the smart city or building out this infrastructure and managing it. What role do we need in cities to help manage this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the standout role to me, and I think the primary mover for this, is the chief data officer. I think that is absolutely vital for a city to have, and their role has to include not just internal traditional items of data warehousing and data management and data security, but data policies as it relates to privacy, communication of those policies to citizens and stakeholders within the community, perhaps buy-in and vetting of those policies with the public, and an aggressive approach to engaging vendors and defining what is viable versus not viable. We've talked a long time about the idea in the country about a digital bill of rights for data for citizens. I think it's probably a bridge too far to expect that to happen at a national level. So each community, however you decide to define that, probably needs to take that step of defining a bill of rights or some sort of statement of rights for people living within the community whose data is being collected through city services, what they're willing to do with that so the citizen doesn't have to manage every data stream individually by themselves. That's a primary mover. That's before you even get to departments of who might do things like installing them or maintaining or providing power. But just what you are allowed to do with that in the first place is the primary mover, I think, needed in every city to make that happen intelligently.
I think there are a lot of challenges to setting up some kind of bill of rights. How do you think cities should go about doing it?
Yeah, that's a great question again. So if I was going to do it, understanding that a lot of follow-on cities, that this is a really first adopter, an early adopter phase, and a lot of other cities would leverage the work being done by these early adopters. But if I was going to do it as a community, I would sit down, I would get one or two members from my city services team on there. And those might be my data warehouse folks. That might be my public utilities folks. It might be traffic, depending on where we were targeting our smart city services. I would include on there one or two officials from a local anchor institution, a university, community college, somebody from the education sphere who could speak to sort of the greater, broader national issues around privacy, around data management, and around public service. I would bring in a few local business representatives, so some pillar businesses that might be located in your region that are interested in using data, to hear from their side of what are they interested in getting, what can they sacrifice, what's the value that can be returned to the community by collecting that. And I would also bring in a couple of citizen representatives. Those might be nonprofit representatives, particularly from organizations that represented vulnerable populations, be that elderly, be that the homeless, or someone who might be inadvertently impacted by data collected from these efforts. And then I would get them into a single room. I would work through those policy elements. I would adopt a explicit opt-in policy rather than opt-out. I think that's one of the pitfalls that we assume all things are permitted unless you explicitly opt out of it. I think that that creates too many loopholes and unintended consequences. I think you have to come with an explicit opt-in policy. So bringing together those people, taking an opt-in point of view, and then writing that bill of rights of what can and can't be done. And it also includes some easy low bar way to amend that going forward, to make additional opt-in clauses to that, and then inform the citizens of how that process goes. I think that would be the way to really move forward.
Okay, so you have done the work here. This is probably a year's long worth of effort. What do you do next? When you go to vendors, what is their reaction likely to be? Or maybe going to vendors isn't the next step.
No, I think going vendor inclusion is a good way to go about this because they have to implement it. Now, I've talked with a number of vendors, and I can tell you what they're going to want to, they'll be flexible to whatever the needs of the cities are. Where this gets unwieldy for them is if every city comes back to them with a different set of recommendations. And that's where I think this idea of forming partnerships with other similar communities, they don't have to be next door to you geographically. They could be across the country, similar demographics, similar population size, similar infrastructure deployments. If you have similar policies and these early adopters are talking to one another and forming this community of communities and discussing what are the important parts of their policies, we will emerge with sets of cities that have similar aggregated needs. And they might enter into some co-op arrangement or some community agreement. They might even enter into something like at US Ignite, we have something called the Smart Gigabit Communities Program, which is over 30 now communities nationally who are bought into collaborating with one another on these smart city efforts. So these intercity collaborations are a great way to form a common interface out to vendors. If a single city, even the size of New York, goes to a vendor and says, these are my individual needs, they're going to be hesitant to enter into an explicit single city agreement. But if 20 cities, if 30 cities come to a vendor and say, these are our common needs, and we're all going to agree to the similar policy, the vendor knows that that's a viable, manageable infrastructure for them. So I think that they would react very, very well to that. The component to face after that really, though, is the procurement and funding process in most cities. And I think people are quickly going to realize that's a barrier. The process of RFPs that keep things down at the pilot level, I think, is not serving us very well. And that's the next step, is to reexamine how that procurement process works in cities.
Okay, well, maybe this question will address that, or maybe we'll get into that. All of this sounds great. Now, let's talk about how we pay for this. My philosophy is that the city data represents a huge trove of information and infrastructure that a city should lay out and provide for both its citizens and for companies that want to do business in the city or with the city. And I think the city should own the data, and the city should fund that maybe through bonds that are, I don't know, revenue bonds, something like that. But I would love to hear how cities should think about paying for this.
Yeah, that's absolutely the primary question really to ask, is how do things get paid for? Because that's ultimately what sets everybody's reality. I think that the model that you maybe alluded to in your question, which is the city's owning the infrastructure, is the model that I personally think works best for the city. But to set the stage, what we're coming out of, what typically cities do is they contract services. They don't usually build their own services, especially when it comes to technology, networking, and other elements that might be necessary for technological infrastructure. They typically get into a contract with a vendor. Let's use fiber networks as an example of this. Typically, what it was is they'll go in, they'll give some right of way under the streets for some vendor to go in and put in their own fiber. That vendor owns the fiber. A lot of times they'll negotiate a contract with the city that's 10 years, 20 years, or even longer, where they own exclusively the rights to that traffic in the city, and maybe they even own that conduit, and nothing can be changed, and it locks the city in over time. It really hamstrings their ability to evolve as technology evolves, and it's limited everybody. Now, vendors wouldn't give you that feedback. They would say it provides a lot of great service to the city, and I'm not going to get into that argument other than to say that that's not my point of view. I think a better emerging model is the bond and lease model, which is the city itself will own, again, we'll use networking as an example, but this can apply to streetlights, it can apply to IoT devices, it can apply to any sort of hardware and software service on top of it. But in networking cases, the city will actually own the fiber. They will pay to have it installed. They will buy the fiber itself. They will run maintenance on it. And what they do is usually issue a bond that the citizens will vote on. They have to make a case for that to the citizens about why they want to issue this bond. And the citizens might approve it. It goes to building out that infrastructure. And from there, the city will lease access back to carriers who might want to use it to deliver their networking services. It's a win-win, in my opinion, because the city retains ownership of it. They're not locked into a long-term contract. They can upgrade it if needed, do all the kind of maintenance that needs to be. The vendor does not have to make this huge capital investment to install this local infrastructure to begin to offer their services. And it actually does provide some benefit to that vendor. And over time, that chargeback is enough to recoup the investment or to repay off that bond from the city in a 5-year picture or 8-year picture or something like that. The additional benefit of that I really want to call out is jobs for the local community. If a city installs it, they're probably not going to have a city worker do the maintenance on it. They're probably going to contract out that maintenance to some local entity within the community who has the contract from the city to do the day-to-day maintenance. And that's a great relationship with local commercial entities and local businesses as well as national entities that might do things like network carrying or data aggregation. So I think that's a great model. I think more and more cities are moving to it. Again, like everything I've mentioned, this does require a higher tier of management acumen, a little bit more complexity in terms of the relationships involved and how it is all managed. But I think that's effort well made on behalf of the city.
Okay, so to clarify, we're taking the fiber model, so the municipal fiber model, they deploy that. Mm. We're thinking about it for other networks, so maybe citywide Wi-Fi, maybe a citywide LoRaWAN network. We're even talking about the city contracting for, but city owning and maintaining the sensors, perhaps, that they're using. All of this, yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. That I think that the model is very successful.
I like it. I like it. And I like your note about jobs. Let's then talk about who oversees this at the city, because you're talking about needing a level of management acumen. I feel like when I talk to people who are CIOs at city levels or CTOs, they're all like, So is this a new role or...
That's a good question. I think it could be done a number of different ways. I personally see this as a new role. I think that traditional IT departments still being responsible for the support and maintenance of internal city systems is important, but this is more like a utility to me. And we've heard that term before, that networks are more like utilities. I think we need to start seeing IoT arrays, data devices, other things like that, similarly to utilities. It's not that different from even community utility departments have some interfacing with local IT for support. They have some interfacing with billing and contract agencies within the community. So I don't think it's actually that different. It would be a utility. Its funding is mostly made up by leaseback and revenue share from the services that they're putting into place within the community. There might even be some budget lines around the community not wanting to lease it out and maintaining ownership of it. But I do think we will, I don't know how long it will take, but I think somewhere in the nebulous future, we will have utility departments that are about technology utilities. And we will have wondered why we didn't land on that right away.
So I like this. I like this model. Very exciting. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Scott.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, if you'd like more IoT news, sign up for my newsletter at stacyoniot.com. We'll see you next week. Thank you.